You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by the MLB.com Shop.
It's time for the American League West, where we catch you up on a little bit of news and introduce you to some key new faces to get to know. Greg, we missed you last week. I had just assumed that you were probably still hanging out at Griffey's house, taking family photos and the like. Hope you had a great week, though, man.
I did, and I have not got the return invite to Griffey's house. I don't know what that means, but was happy to have a week off with my wife down in San Francisco, and enjoyed the heck out of that. And glad to be back on duty now, getting ready for spring training coming around the corner now.
Right on, yeah. I mean, it is right around the corner, so that opens up an opportunity for us to maybe introduce folks to a new face, new name. At least, you know, like on the big league side, it could be somebody coming up through the system, maybe somebody acquired this offseason, and Lord knows that would give you plenty of guys to choose from. So who are we going to get to know this week?
You know, they do have a ton of guys, and a guy I pick out that I think would be fun to look at is Nori Aoki. I think a guy that the fans are going to really love, and I think is really going to be a key to success for this team. That's the leadoff guy. So I think Nori Aoki really one of the more interesting offseason acquisitions out of a whole bunch that Jerry Dipoto has made.
So what is it about Aoki that you're like, although before you jump into that, I'll say this. I was looking at his numbers not long ago, and it is uncanny how consistent hitter he is. I mean, every year, every batting average, on base percentage, slugging, it's like within a point or two of one another. He's ridiculously consistent.
It's crazy, Dave, and that's one of the reasons they got him. Jerry Dipoto loves that consistency and kind of knowing what you're going to get, and in a critical position that they've been looking to fill here for a while at that leadoff spot. But you're right. I mean, he's played 4 years in the big leagues, and I don't think I've ever seen it before. I mean, his four batting averages: 285, 286, 287, and 288. And the only thing he didn't do is do those in order. I mean, they've gone back and forth, but to stay within 4 points over four seasons is, it's pretty stunning, and those are numbers you can certainly like and live with. On base as well, he's been very consistent up there in the 350 to 360 range, and you know what you're going to get with Nori Aoki, assuming he stays healthy, and that's a big part of what they need and what they want, you know, in that leadoff spot.
There is always the question of production, what a guy is going to give you on the field, and then there is that. Those intangibles, what he provides, just, you know, in the clubhouse, on the bus, on the charters. When he was signed, and it was a while ago now, but as I recall, he had some quote about being excited about the coffee and what he felt like was a chance to win a World Series. I love that. It sounds like he's a guy with a little sense of humor, but also a guy who really believed that this move for him was about being competitive and a chance to do what everybody's aiming to do, which is play for the ring.
No doubt. And you're right, personality exudes from this kid when we met him, and I've heard that from his previous days. Certainly, I think the fans are going to like this. Reminds me a little bit of Munenori Kawasaki, who was a guy that came in. It was just kind of just fun to watch. Just his love for the game and kind of love for being around people was catching, you know, and Aoki has some of that. I don't know if he's quite as over the top as Munenori, who was kind of one of the all-timers as far as personality, but Aoki seems to have that in a big way, and that'll be fun. I think you got to like the game, you got to enjoy it, and that seems to be a big part of what he brings. And you're right, that is important, and especially for the Japanese players coming over, and sometimes there's a language barrier and things. You can make up for a lot of that just by being happy and being enjoying being around guys and part of the game, and I think we're going to see a lot of that with Aoki.
So consistency being maybe his main calling card, although the numbers themselves are actually pretty good as well, right? I mean, the one thing we do know is he's probably not going to steal more bases than he has in the past, and he's probably not going to hit a whole lot more home runs than he's hit in the past, just because he's over that, you know, that hump of the late 20s. But Is there upside for him, do you think? Does he represent an opportunity to surprise in some way?
Well, that's a great question. I guess we'll find out. I read an interesting story in the Japan Times a couple days ago, and Aoki's over there working out, and he talked with a reporter it was an English speaking newspaper, so I was actually able to read it. But one of the quotes is pretty eye catching, and you know, take it for what it's worth. But Aoki working out and says, "Hey, I want to do one of two things. I want to either win a batting title or a stolen base crown." I mean, this is his goal. So if there's upside, he believes there certainly is. You know, this is a guy that he does have a remarkable ability of getting bat on the ball and getting on base and doing things. And, you know, you want to talk numbers. I mean, his career 353 on-base percentage is a number one of why he's in Seattle. That's a key area for DePoto to look at to improve on a team whose on-base last year was 311 as a group. 353 they like, especially in that leadoff spot. And looking last year, I mean, they tried a lot of different guys. They really have since Ichiro left. You know, they've really been trying to find that guy, that catalyst at the top of the lineup. And last year, you know, they had Austin Jackson. They tried Logan Morrison, was led off 20 games last year. You know, Seth Smith was the leadoff hitter 18 times. And they tried Ricky Weeks, you know, Ackley, Brad Miller, Justin Rougeon. I mean, they're rolling guys out there just trying to find something. And last third of the season, they brought up Ketel Marte, the young shortstop, and he did a pretty good job there. He actually put up numbers that they could probably live with, but they want the kind of that experienced guy with Aoki, and no question he's going to fill that role. But as you talk about what do you want in that leadoff spot, last year the Mariners last in baseball, 30 teams, Dave, in runs scored by their leadoff guy, 76 runs out of that leadoff spot, and that's a number they want to change. And you got to think, you know, with your Cano, your Nelson Cruz, your Seager in the middle of that order, you get a guy on base, you should be able to get him around. You're looking at a pretty good thing, but you gotta get a guy on and make something happen, and that's what they're looking at with Aoki. So again, numbers, hey, on base last year, 247 batting average for their leadoff guy. You know, Aoki a career 287, 307 was their on base for the leadoff spot. You know, Aoki a 353 career. So if he's living by those career numbers, even close to him, they're getting a significant upgrade there in that leadoff spot. So it really should be interesting, and that's offensively. So, you know, of course, defense, a whole other side of the game that we can talk about as well. But that's why they like Aoki, and certainly as I see him to be a big part of this team going forward.
CR, we're, a month away, I guess really a little less than a month away from guys reporting to spring training. There are some changes this year. We've talked in the past, Doug Brocale, new pitching coach, but new hitting coach as well. I approach it. What do you know about him, and what should fans, or for that matter, the Rangers offense, be looking forward to?
Well, Anthony Iapochi was a very interesting hitting coach hire for the Rangers. He replaces Dave Magadin. He's never been in the big leagues before in any capacity. He was the Cubs' special assistant for minor league hitting the last 3 years. He comes in with the mentality of being the Rangers' offensive coordinator, kind of the football mentality, but that's part of how Rangers manager Jeff Bannister approaches his team. And basically, Iapochi's main goal is for the Rangers to find a way to score runs every night, whether you're facing Felix Hernandez or some rookie just brought up from AAA, or some guy who's struggling, or, you know, C.J. Wilson, no matter what, you got to find a way to score runs each night. Going through the scouting report, you know, running the bases, you know, taking pitches or swinging away, being aggressive at the plate. Each night is different. Each pitcher is different. Each team is different. You know, one night you're going to have Cole Hamels pitching for the Rangers. Another night you'll have Colby Lewis, Derek Holland, or, again, a young guy up in the minor leagues like Anthony Renato. The basic goal is to find a way to score runs, however you can do it, and just be a run-scoring mentality of finding a way each night, grinding out every pitch, every at-bat, and, you know, doing what it takes to win a baseball game. You know, it's not so much, Dave, about the swing and the mechanics and all of that, which, you know, obviously are important, but what the Rangers want to do is win the ball game. You know, it's a game of strategy, just like Monopoly or chess. And, you know, it's like Ron Washington used to say, you know, do what the game presents yourself. It's the same mentality. It's finding a way in that situation to get the job done.
So that sounds really unique to me, TR. I mean, that's that kind of thinking, no doubt, has been going on for a long time, people trying to figure out angles. But as a hitting coach, as a guy in uniform every day, is there precedence for this? And it seems like it's always been about the mechanics, right? To get the foot down, the timing, the swing plane, et cetera. This seems like a little departure from that.
I think it's a little bit. I think a lot of hitting coaches in the past, you know, have had the Ted Williams philosophy of, you know, the science of hitting, how to become a great hitter. And, you know, and that's still going to be part of it. You want to make sure your hitters are the best that they can be. But what you want is the mentality of winning a baseball game. You know, the old Ron Washington philosophy that helped him to two World Series. I mean, that part doesn't change. You know, you got a baseball game going on, and if you have a runner on second base and nobody out, you're not thinking about mechanics. You're thinking about getting the runner over. You know, if you have the bases loaded, you're trying to hit a fly ball. I mean, it's just about playing situational baseball, winning baseball, you know, trying to win the game.
I love it. I love it. It sounds great. Is there somebody, though, who will be on staff to concern themselves with that breakdown of film and the small mechanical adjustments as well?
I mean, you still got a 9-man coaching staff, and they have Bobby Jones there, who was the assistant hitting coach last year. And they got Justin Mayshore, who was being brought up from AAA to be the assistant hitting coach. And Justin's a guy who's worked with a lot of these young kids throughout their minor league career, and he knows them, and he'll be able to help them with that. You know, Anthony Arapocha will still do that too. I mean, it's not more of an emphasis. It's more expanding your role as a hitting coach to be more than just a mechanics guy, to be a winning baseball hitting coach. And, you know, Dave Magadan was like that too. I mean, it's not a radical departure, but, you know, this is what Anthony Arapocha brings to the staff, and this is what Jeff Bannister wants brought to the staff.
Very interesting. Interesting story on Rangers.com about Iapochi. You know, one of the big pieces of that offense that he'll be working with is Adrian Beltre. It's been a while since we've talked about Beltre, who, in October, had surgery on his thumb. Any updates on that? And I know there's been some talks about maybe contract extensions. Anything on that out there?
Well, number one, Beltre had the surgery, like you said, at the end of the season, Dave. And he's come into FanFest this week. He's feeling good. He was working out at the ballpark at Globe Life Park. The Rangers expect him to be at full strength in spring training. They expect him to be healthy. They expect him to have a big year. You know, he's going to be 37 years old in April, and he's at the end of his contract. This is his last year. He'll be a free agent at the end of next season or this coming season. But, you know, Dave, this is still a, you know, frontline third baseman. He can still play defense. You know, we saw at the end of the season last year, in the second half of the season, how well he was performing, and that was with the bad thumb. You know, the Rangers still like this guy. The Rangers still can conceivably see him at third base beyond this year. You know, we do know that Joey Gallo is getting close, probably need a year at AAA or at least part-time this year to, you know, kind of regain his confidence. And, you know, he could be the third baseman of the future, but the Rangers have certainly talked about a contract extension for Adrian Beltre. And I don't think Beltre wants to retire. He just wants to continue to be on a winning team in a winning situation. I mean, like I said, he's 37 years old, and he, you know, he wants to win. He does not have that World Series ring. He's been in one World Series. The Rangers didn't win it. He wants to be on the winning end of it.
Yeah, well, let's face it. A guy like him, the fun he appears to have on the field every day, I mean, I'm sure he would never want to retire. Go the Julio Franco route. Well, by the way, I heard he's still playing in Japan. Alden, let's start with left field. Since we last spoke, I mean, up and now off the board, Nationals apparently in heavy pursuit of Yoenis Cespedes, like many teams have claimed to be to this point. And there's still very clearly a need in left field for this Angels team. Any updates, any news on what they may be doing?
Yeah, Dave, I continue to hear that nothing has really changed with the Angels situation, which means they still don't want to exceed the luxury tax threshold for next year. and they're still not making a run at Yoenis Céspedes, even though he is the last of the big-name left fielders remaining on the board, and even though he fits in kind of perfectly with what they need. Angels owner Artie Moreno said it publicly in November. He said that he didn't like where the prices were at, and he kind of expressed his reluctancy to exceed the threshold, which is something that, you know, it's been pretty much his stance for a while. It's pretty much been the Angels' spending limit for the last few years. And, you know, we talked a lot, Dave, this offseason about whether or not maybe that would change this offseason because the Angels have money coming off the books next year with C.J. Wilson and Jared Weaver, and because that threshold would go up. Apparently, that's not the case. The threshold is still pretty much their spending limit. I don't rule the Angels out on any of these guys until they come off the board, simply because the Angels have surprised us before with Albert Pujols and Josh Hamilton, and because the fit is there. It's very real. But it doesn't look like it's going to happen. Angels fans have been blowing up my Twitter feed for the last couple of months, disappointed that the Angels aren't signing these big-name guys. Fans always look for those big-name signings. But right now, if the season started today, it would be a platoon of Craig Gentry and Daniel Nava in left field. I don't think Billy Epler is ready to proclaim that just yet. I spoke to him as recently as a couple of days ago. I think he's still holding out for another move, for maybe adding an everyday left fielder, and if not, trading for maybe another option at second base. But right now, you know, the offseason is almost over. Free agents are finally starting to come off the board, even though it's been a slow market. And it's hard to see where the Angels can turn in terms of trades. I still expect them to, at some point, trade one of their starting pitchers because, I mean, they have some real depth there. And, you know, they could really use that depth to address some holes in their lineup. But as of right now, it's just hard to see where those improvements are going to come from.
Well, it's funny because I think we have talked about, and I'm sure some fans have held out a little hope that, yes, the threshold is there. But, man, if there was just some way they could move one of those big contracts with so much pitching already on staff, maybe that would have opened up an opportunity. When you look at a guy like Céspedes, though, I mean, look, the Nationals are talking about what a great fit he would be in D.C., and that indeed may be where he ends up. He'd probably be a great fit just about anywhere, but you really like the way he would have fit in with his Angels team.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, you know, and it's easy to say that in a vacuum. You're not factoring length of contract and how much he would be paid. And, you know, if he gets a five-year deal, you're paying him a significant amount of money well into his 30s, just like you're doing with Albert Pujols. And I'm sure there's some reluctancy in, from that standpoint. Just putting aside the payroll, there's always reluctancy to pay these guys an absorbent amount of money when they're getting up in that age range. But if you just look at it in a vacuum of how he helps the Angels right now, I mean, Yoenis Céspedes may not be the elite defender that could cover center field, but as a left fielder in that outfield with Mike Trout and Cole Calhoun and with his throwing arm, that would have been probably the best defensive outfield in baseball. And it's not only that, it's his big right-handed bat that would fit in perfectly in the middle of the lineup. If you have a middle of the order of Mike Trout, Albert Pujols, and Yoenis Céspedes, now all of a sudden that lineup is at a whole new level. And, you know, I feel like, you know, a lot of outsiders have told me and that, you know, they feel like the Angels need somebody like that. That's the only real way that the Angels could be a legit title contender is if they sign a guy like Yoenis Céspedes, because they need that extra impact bat in their lineup, and it's not really coming up through their system. And then, you know, obviously Billy Epler and the Angels would argue that they feel like they have a contending team right now. But then the other part of Céspedes that I think was appealing is that he was not tied to draft pick compensation. Because he was traded from the Tigers to the Mets in the middle of the season, he cannot be offered the qualifying offer, and so signing him would not have cost the Angels their first-round pick. And, you know, for an Angels team that's looking, that really needs to beef up its system, that lost its top two prospects, those first-round picks are very, 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 very valuable to them, which is why a lot of people felt like Céspedes was the best fit, even when guys like Hayward and Alex Gordon and Justin Upton were still on the board. But, again, I mean, the budget is the budget. There's nothing that Billy Epler could do about it. And, you know, the Angels are going into the season with an opening day payroll of about $165 million, which is the highest it's ever been in franchise history. I'm sure that's been added to it as well. And, you know, Dave, the thing about it is, as we talked about before, the budget does open up next year. You have Jared Weaver, you have C.J. Wilson hitting free agency, and you have that threshold likely going up with the new CBA. The problem with it is the free agent market is not very good next year. So it's going to be interesting to see what the Angels do.
Well, let's turn it from what could have been, what may never be, to what actually has happened, which is, you know, the Angels do have some new faces coming in, and there are some players that fans will be getting a look at for the first time in an Angels uniform. Is there somebody, you know, we talk about getting to know somebody before spring training. Who should fans get to know?
Well, I think, Dave, without a doubt, the most exciting player, the biggest name the Angels acquired this offseason and a really exciting player is going to be Andrelton Simmons. You know, fans don't really realize, I think Angels fans aren't really familiar with Andrelton Simmons too much because he plays for the Braves. They never really play against him. But and because they also, for good reason, loved Eric Ibar. He was a homegrown guy. He brought so much to the team. He was kind of a spiritual leader in some sense, clutch hitter for them, tough competitor. But I don't think a lot of Angels fans realize just how good Andrelton Simmons is defensively. I mean, I wrote a story about him back in November, and I spent pretty much an entire day looking through Andrelton Simmons' highlights. And the range that that guy had, all the way to his right, all the way to his left, I had never seen anything like it. I spoke to a couple of people in the Braves organization. I spoke to some people. I spoke to his coach in junior college. I spoke to the scout who signed him. And, you know, it seems like everybody has a story about the Andrelton Simmons play that they saw that they just couldn't believe. He does things that other shortstops just cannot do. He was, you know, he grew up in Curacao. He was a really, really good soccer player. When he was about 16, 17 years old, you know, he was a really skinny kid. A lot of teams passed up on the opportunity to sign him as an international free agent back then. He was considering a career in soccer. And I think all that exposure to soccer probably gave him the footwork that he has. He has a rocket arm. He pitched in junior college, and the Braves actually drafted him as a pitcher because he was throwing upper 90s fastballs with a really mean slider. The problem is that he refused to sign as a pitcher. He wanted to go in as a position player because he felt like he was a dynamic defensive shortstop, and he really is. I mean, I remember his junior college told me about a play that Simmons made. I think they were in the junior college World Series, and they needed one more out to finish the game. This kid hits a really high fly ball to deep left field near the warning track. Their left fielder loses the ball in the lights. Andrelton Simmons realizes it. He darts all the way back to the warning track, and he makes an over-the-shoulder catch right in front of the left field warning track from shortstop. There is nobody else in baseball that can do something like that. And if you look through his highlights, you'll see some at the major league level that you just really can't believe a guy can get there. And, you know, the interesting thing about him is his bat hasn't come around yet. There are some people in the Braves organization who feel like the Angels are kind of getting him at the right time because they feel like he has such great hands. He's got such great awareness at the plate. They feel like he should be better than what he has been offensively. So maybe the Angels start to see that a little bit. But even if they don't, this guy's going to make some really head-turning plays all year. And, look, I don't know if the Angels are going to score many runs this year. Left field continues to be a problem for them. But on a nightly basis, you're going to get to see Andrelton Simmons, Mike Trout, and Cole Calhoun play defense. Those are three really dynamic defensive players. I think that in itself is going to be pretty fun to watch.
B-Tag, okay, this time of year, typically not a whole lot of newsy things happening with most teams. With the exception, perhaps, in your case, of Dallas Keuchel's arbitration, decision, a little over $7 million. What did you make of all that news?
Yeah, Dallas reached a $7.25 million deal with Astros for 2016. And, you know, for a Cy Young winner, I know when it came out, a lot of people are like, well, how come the Astros only paying him $7.25 million? Why aren't they paying him $15 million? But, you know, the way the system works is, well, for the first time, and actually his deal, $7.25 million, is a record for a starting pitcher when the first time he's eligible for arbitration. It's not even close. He shattered the previous record by more than $2 million. So, and talking to Dallas shortly after he signed the deal, it was pretty interesting. He was saying that he's excited to get it, obviously, but he was hoping that this can kind of open the door for some other guys, some other starting pitchers as they come along to get similar deals or even better deals, and that, it's not a record that's going to stand for a few years. He would like to see some guys behind him do even better than he does. But, I know Dallas will have 2 years left, and, you know, if he keeps pitching like he does, he's going to make a lot of money. Maybe the Astros try to sign a long-term deal at some point, but, you know, the closer a pitcher gets to arbitration and the more success he has, the harder that becomes to do. But as of right now, the Astros really getting Dallas' title for what he gives them for $7.25 million is a pretty good deal.
Yeah, very cool that he looks at it as perhaps a way to further the progress for future pitchers or players in arbitration. The other thing is about arbitration, it's always considered, you know, that's a team control thing, and you're more than likely going to get guys at a bargain of what they would get in the open market. And I'm sure that's true in Keuchel's case, but it seems like those savings, right, that they typically realize, those are shrinking a little bit with deals like that.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, that's why, you know, teams, you know, debate whether they try to sign some players they think have potential, try to sign them before they hit arbitration and buy out those arbitration years. Just look at Jose Altuve, for example. You know, the Astros signed him pretty early into his career, bought out his arbitration, and that was before he won a batting title and before he was a Gold Glove winner. And right now that looks like a terrific deal for the Astros. I think it was like, I don't have it in front of me, but 4 years, $17 million, maybe with a couple options. So, and boy, that's a great deal for the Astros right now. When they signed it at the time, you're like, yeah, you know, let's see what happens. And so teams are willing to roll the dice on that a little bit to save even more money in arbitration because, like you said, Keuchel getting a record deal and, you know, Jake Arrieta is asking for a lot of money. He and the Cubs are quite far apart. So, I think some of these guys are trying to get what they're worth, and the market keeps going up.
Yeah, meanwhile, a guy who is probably past those heady days has come back to the Houston Astros, Wandy Rodriguez, in a minor league deal. What's the thinking here? I mean, obviously, everybody needs and wants depth, but is there a possibility that fans in Houston could see Wandy Rodriguez in that rotation in April?
Well, I think if they do, that probably means something went wrong. I mean, nothing against Wandy. You know, he's 37 years old. He was released by the Braves last year. He made 10 starts for the Rangers and did okay. I think he even retired, 34 hitters in a row over a two-stretch start. But I think he's more of an emergency guy at this point, just a guy who has some experience they could plug in if something went wrong, if there's health issues. I mean, they're having a look at the health of Brad Peacock coming off an injury. You know, Scott Feldman's had a shoulder injury. So how are those guys going to bounce back? So it's kind of an inventory thing. They can bring him in. They know he's going to be comfortable here. He's left-handed. He's probably going to pitch forever. But, yeah, you know, Wandy's best days are behind him. I mean, he's 11 years removed from pitching the World Series for the Astros. But it's going to be fun to have him back around. I know you know him, Dave, and he's kind of a fun-loving guy and brings some positive energy to the clubhouse.
Yeah, it's an interesting signing, and I definitely a guy who could help the team in certain situations. As we get closer and closer to spring training, Brian, we've thought about this week being a get-to-know-you kind of week. New faces come every year for teams, whether they're, you know, just graduating up the system of the minor leagues or off-season acquisitions. Is somebody that you'd like to spotlight this week? Fans are going to be excited to get to know.
Well, I think Ken Giles is the one guy that everybody's wanting to know more about. I mean, he's really the only big-time newcomer on the team this year. Of course, they traded away four players to the Phillies to get him, but had a chance to visit with Giles a little bit on Thursday at the caravan stop at Chick-fil-A, and you could really see his personality come out. He's from New Mexico. He's big into, you know, motorcycles and fixing cars and that kind of thing. And the interesting thing about Giles, I think, he's 25 years old. We all know he throws 100 miles an hour. great stuff with the Phillies last year in the second half of the year. There's still not a long track record on him, and he's only a couple of years away from walking a lot of guys in the minor league a couple of years ago. So, you know, Astros taking a little bit of the roll of the dice, but you just can't ignore that power arm and that stuff that he has. And where I'm going with this is he's entering a bullpen. He's going to be the closer at 25 years old on a bullpen really full of veterans, Gregerson, Neshek, Harris, Gregerson and Neshek over 30, Tony Sipp, another guy, 30, maybe 29, 30 years old. So this veteran bullpen is going to be looking at this guy in the ninth inning. You know, it's going to come with some pressure. He's going to be pitching in playoff games for the first time in his career, and that's going to come with some pressure. But he's a very interesting guy. Seems like a very nice guy. And I know when he signed, I asked him, you know, when was the first time he learned to throw 100 miles an hour? And he's like, that's what everyone always asked me. And I think it was his junior year in college, or maybe between sophomore and junior year, bullpen, the ball just started flying out of his hand. And ever since then, he's been on the fast track to the major league. So it's going to be fun to watch him, fun to watch the radar gun when he comes in. And we can only hope he has some success and starts piling up those saves.
Jane, it's been a couple of weeks. We've had a great time talking with Ken Korak. How have you been?
I'm good. I'm a little tanner than I last spoke to you after a nice long vacation.
Good for you. So I got a question for you, and I'm sure this is the type of thing that is on your mind as well. But, you know, I look around the American League West division, and left field is a fascinating position. It was a disaster for the Angels. The Rangers, you know, went out and they got Josh Hamilton and fit him in there, but he can't stay healthy, and it's sort of an ongoing question mark for them. And last year it was the same story for the Oakland A's. Is there all these teams seem to be continuing to search for answers in left field? What do you think as you look to 2016 in left field for Oakland?
Yeah, I don't think there's a clear answer, but the A's at least have a lot of options. They've, you know, since they really haven't been able to rely on Coco Crisp there, with him just dealing with a lot of injuries these past few years, notably just a chronic neck issue that you know, has prevented him from being on the field. They've you know, been very good at just acquiring depth and good depth at the position, guys that can platoon. You know, Sam Fold and Jake Smolinski both did well for them last year, and since then they've added Andrew Lambeau to the mix. And then, of course, there's Mark Canna, who can also play first base, but with Yonder Alonso in the mix now at first base, we could see Canna playing a little left more if Chris, you know, is not healthy. The A's, of course, are hoping he will be. The neck thing, the best recipe for the neck getting better is rest. So the off season, you know, he always feels the best right after the off season, and you know, he's usually pretty healthy going into spring training, but from there, things are just kind of uncertain. It really is day to day with him. And I think that's just how it's going to be the rest of his career. You know, playing on the field, it's not easy for him with the neck injury. So even when he is playing, I think we could see him DHing a lot as he did last year, when he was, you know, off the DL. But I think they, you know, they're realistic with the fact that he just hasn't been able to stay on the field. So, you know, they have to give themselves options. And I think, you know, they put themselves in the best possible situation, you know, given the circumstances surrounding Coco.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like a situation with him where, I mean, am I incorrect in saying it's not the type of thing that's going to get a whole lot better? I mean, it's just kind of always be an issue?
It is, and, you know, he does have the option of surgery, but he's been told that surgery would probably put an end to his career. So, you know, it's either deal with it as is and try to play when able, or have the surgery and, you know, say goodbye to, you know, what's been a really long career for him. So, you know, obviously he wants to keep playing, but he's, you know, he's very smart about it. I think he's been around long enough to, you know when it's bothering, when to play it safe, because the neck is something you really don't, you know, you want to be very careful with. you know, and it affects all aspects of his game. Obviously, you know, playing on the field, that's rough for him. He's a very aggressive player, too. You know, his defensive style is all out, and he can't really hold back. You know, when you've played the game the same way your whole life, you know, you can't just stop doing that. So that's why being on the field for him is a little difficult in that regard, and even batting. I mean, he's a switch hitter, and, you know, the way he turns his neck when he's batting, that's often bothersome, too, and it really is something that's not going to go away. He's constantly, you know, getting treatment, you know, getting as much rest as possible, but this is something that, you know, everyone knows that he is going to just have to deal with, and they're going to have to work around, you know, as best as possible.
So, sort of changing directions a little bit here, Jane, you go from, you know, kind of a legacy player there in Oakland and his situation to new faces. And this week, maybe a little get to know you moment for fans, as we think about, you know, who may be a contributor this year who was not with the club last year, maybe an acquisition, a former minor leaguer, something like that. Is there somebody that comes to mind for you fans might do well to get to know?
Yeah, I think you know, Yonder Alonso is a guy that I think, you know, fans are going to come to like. You know, the A's were very high on him, gave up Drew Pomeranz for him. And I think it was clear going into the offseason that defense was going to be a priority for them after a pretty poor performance in that area last year. And, you know, Alonso's defensive prowess is clearly, you know, valued by the A's when they decided to, you know, let go of Pomeranz. I think, you know, at the time of the trade, I remember David Forst, you know, calling him one of the best defensive first basemen in the game, if not the best. And because of that, you know, he said, this is a guy that we see maybe playing every day. And, of course, Canna will stay in that mix. But I think the A's are maybe looking at, you know, a solid fixture at the position. And it's a position that was kind of, you know, it was kind of lacking last year in terms of production. Ike Davis, of course, missed a lot of the year because of injuries. Canna held his own over there, but I think they were really looking for stability and defensive stability as well. You know, he, of course, doesn't really profile as your typical corner infield. He's not a power guy. He hasn't hit more than 9 home runs in a single season, and I believe no more than 7 since 2012, but he's always gotten on base a lot, something the A's like. And he has a decent amount of plate discipline, too. You know, he doesn't strike out a lot. So a guy that, you know, they like just his all-around talent. And I think also you look around the diamond, and I think it's no secret that Marcus Semien had his struggles last year at shortstop. So, you know, putting a solid defender at first base, you know, can only help, you know, in that regard too. When you're dealing with guys who maybe do have some defensive struggles, getting throws across, so I think that's a guy that's going to be just a solid answer there defensively. And I think whatever comes offensively will be a bonus. You know, he'll hit, you know, around 280, 285. You know, drive in some runs, get on base, and I think that's what the A's expect out of him.